Now, for those of us trying to understand cultures and nations beyond our shores, sometimes there's no better guide than the way a sporting star becomes mythologised by the people, way beyond maybe the star's inherent physical prowess. So it seems to be with the man we'll discuss now. Some listeners will have made a deep study of him, but most of us will have but a passing knowledge of this huge character from post-war US history, who came to symbolise so much of the hopes, the dreams, and somehow then the brittleness of fame in mid-20th century America. He was but a baseball player who played 13 seasons with the Yankees, but what a player. In 1937 alone, he made 46 home runs. He drove in 67 runs. He scored the most runs at 151. And at .673, had the highest slugging average. He was a true superstar. Then he married a bigger one, Marilyn Monroe. And that was a whole new story in the life of this most enigmatic of men. But I might let Jerome Charon take us a bit further. He's written an engaging new slim book called Joe DiMaggio, The Long Vigil, with an enchanting picture on its cover of Joe and Marilyn. He's a widely published author. He just adores America's cultural history, ranging from books on Emily Dickinson to Babe Ruth to Joe DiMaggio. So it's my pleasure to welcome you to Saturday Extra.
Thank you.
Now, for Australians who may not be as steeped in the traditions and the characters of baseball as we are in, say, cricket, where does Joe DiMaggio sit in the pantheon of heroes?
Well, he has a very special place, in part because of Marilyn Monroe, which sort of takes him out of the realm of baseball and puts him into 20th century mythology. But as a baseball player, he had a kind of beauty of performance that almost no other player ever had. He just looked perfect when he played. He had a kind of grace, a kind of elegance that was very rare to see, so that you almost have to see him as much as an artist. It was absolute grace, as if he were a dancer on the field.
Yes, and you make the point, your book makes it clear, that it wasn't just as an athlete that he grabbed America's imagination, something far more in your view. You know, you spend a lot of wonderful words trying to encapsulate it, almost for yourself as well. Help us understand it, please.
It's very hard to, you know, to grasp, because usually it takes a certain amount of time for any kind of athlete in any sport to sort of, you know, gather the intelligence, the experience, etc. But he had a kind of perfection from the first time he appeared on the field, and that's he had a kind of confidence that almost no other ball player ever had, so that when you watched him, he just completely took your breath away. There was no one else who ever looked the way he did when he performed. Mm. And also he was incredibly shy, so that if you look at today's athletes, they're always, first of all, they're incredibly rich, and athletes at this time were not that wealthy. You know, they didn't have managers, they didn't have anyone to take care of their money. They were almost stumble bums. So he really didn't want anything to do with his fans outside of the game itself. He wouldn't give autographs, he wouldn't see people, he wouldn't speak at any kind of charitable events. The only time he gave of himself was on the field.
Well, in fact, you have come to the conclusion, I think, that he was a bit autistic. You say that he fundamentally had trouble with language.
Yeah, he had a terrible problem with language, and to me, his language was the way he played on the field. I mean, that was the way he spoke to us.
Well, you do say that he arrived like a lightning bolt in the middle of the Great Depression and seemed to soothe us all. So there was something, and because his golden period, as you say, was 1936 to 41. And then what I'm interested in now, just moving his chronology along, is why the end of the war changed things irrevocably, really, for him, or the war and the end of the war.
Well, it wasn't only, it was the everything about the war. 1941 was his great season when he hit in 56 consecutive games, and it's almost an impossible feat. So he had to be so concentrated. Okay, It's 1941. America is not yet in the war. There's a tremendous kind of anxiety. So he's the perfect hero for the perfect time. And he performs for us every day. He's consistent in a world of inconsistency. Mm. Okay, then many of the other baseball stars either enlist in the Army or are drafted. He doesn't. He doesn't volunteer himself. So only 1 year later, in 1942, the fans begin to boo him. You know, they want to see their hero go to war. And from this point on, really from this moment on, he's finished as a ball player. He will never regain his form and never will regain his confidence. The world changes around him. It's much more complicated, and he's never really able to deal with it again. He does join the Army in early 43. He comes back to baseball in 46. He doesn't have that same sense of perfection, that same ability to be absolutely concentrated. There's too much on his mind.
Well,
he's almost a haunted man after this.
Indeed, and I just wonder whether you think America shares some blame in this, because you constantly ask yourself, why was there such a haunting dissonance between the man and his image? Or did we impose an image upon him that was utterly removed from the man? What's your verdict?
Well, what you're saying is partly true. The other problem was that he wasn't prepared for anything outside of baseball. This was the language that he understood. And the minute there's a kind of complexity in his life, he gets married, he has a son. His son is born in 1941, and he doesn't know how to be a father. He doesn't know how to behave towards his son, and he's going to have a lifelong problem with him. His wife is going to divorce him. So he really, you know, cannot sort of survive outside the field. The field was a place of protection for him. Mm. He didn't even like to leave the ballpark. He would have stayed there all night if he could.
And then came, as you say, the accident, Marilyn Monroe.
But Marilyn Monroe, who, again, was much too complex for him. He was deeply in love with her and never recovered from that love, whereas she was someone who was very much involved in her own career. And actually, DiMaggio saved her career, you know, because she posed for a nudie calendar. She claimed that she was an orphan. Suddenly, not only is her mother alive, but her mother is an insane asylum, saying, Marilyn, why don't you help me? So she was in deep trouble as a star. But suddenly, when she begins dating DiMaggio, they become the prince and princess of America.
And you think this was arranged by her friend, Sidney Skolsky, in an effort?
Yes.
Saying, but DiMaggio fell hard. That's the point.
Yes, he'd never encountered anyone like her. I mean, she, you know, remember, she's an extraordinary woman. We've never been able to deal with her complexity as a person. You know, we see her as a kind of bimbo with the fake husky voice. That wasn't her voice at all. That was a stage voice. And she's very ambitious. She's the finest comic actress of her time. And it's only after she dies that we really begin to appreciate her. And as her myth builds, DiMaggio's myth is also restored. So that in the 21st century, we see them almost as a kind of magical couple.
Mm. It lasted, I think, in its first round for 10 months, and then there was a tremendous separation, and he obviously, it took terrible toll of him. And then this amazing, I mean, talk about epic events in this man's life. They were due to be remarried. She really did work out that she couldn't live without this man who adored her, even though he was inarticulate. And then her suicide occurs on the day they were due to be remarried.
The day she was buried was the day to be remarried.
Okay.
It's very, very complicated, and we have to be careful when we talk about the word suicide. It was an overdose of drugs. Was it an intended suicide? I don't think so. You know, we talk about her, you know, being in love with Jack Kennedy. She wasn't in love with Jack Kennedy. She was in love with Bobby Kennedy. And on that very day, it's possible, we don't absolutely know, that Bobby may have visited her. He was supposed to be in San Francisco. He may have come to L.A. to see her. She was very upset about the visit. And from this point on, you know, the death sort of creeps in, though we're not quite aware of how it happened.
Mm.
I think it was an overdose of drugs.
But the point is, he was the one who had to identify her body at the morgue and arrange for the funeral.
Yes, because they said, you know, when in trouble, go to DiMaggio. He's the one, he's the fixer. He'll take care of things, you know, because of his absolute devotion to her.
And I think he sent flowers every day. He threw three roses into her open casket, sobbed,
yes,
and sang "I love you" three times in a staccato,
yes,
voice, you write, that was close to incantation. And then what's the flower story from then on in?
Well, she said that, you know, not being morbid about it, but she said that if he outlived her, she would want flowers on her grave. And he didn't do it for the rest of his life. I think he did it three times a week or something like that for 20 years. But he, you know, his whole life, I mean, she was his life, whether she was alive or dead. Mm. She remained his life.
So, as a summary, Jerome, I mean, this has been such a labour of love, I sense, from you in this.
Yes.
Has anyone vaguely like him been seen again? Could they be?
Well, I mean, you could take the various parts, but if you put the whole thing together, the complexity of his game, his involvement with an extraordinary woman, because remember, Marilyn has a kind of complexity as an artist and as a woman and as a performer that we're probably never going to see again. So I don't think we really could duplicate the kind of life that he had.
Well, it's also the American dream, isn't it? The immigrant, his parents were immigrants, and their son,
yes,
achieving the American dream, bittersweet though that is.
Yes, it was the American dream, but in a very strange way, because finally, you know, he wasn't even that interested in baseball. He just happened to be so good at it. And once he started to perform, you know, the sense of performance took over. It was almost effortless for him. You know, he just came out of nowhere and developed into this extraordinary athlete.
Jerome Charon, thank you very much indeed for telling us about it here on Saturday Extra.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for inviting me.
And Jerome's book is called Joe DiMaggio, The Long Vigil. It's published by Yale University Press, and whether you're a sporty or not, I think you'll get quite something out of it.